Hello, welcome to Whiskey Congress. My name is Jim. I'm here with my buddy Steve. You may remember us from Steve and Jim Fix the World While Drinking. We're moving on. We are now WhiskeyCongress.com. Steve, I'm excited about this.
Yes, I am too. I am. This is something that's been a long time in the making. We have been working on developing a new brand and a new direction. And really, it's about bringing our audience more all across the board. It's bringing them more content, bringing them better content across multiple platforms. We have the website, WhiskeyCongress.com. We have a YouTube channel that is Whiskey Congress. Twitter, Facebook, even Pinterest, Instagram, all of it at Whiskey Congress. So if you're looking for us, you can find us. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can find us on Google Play, Stitcher, multiple platforms. We wanted to expand our reach because, you know, that's what you do, right? You want to continue to grow.
It was tough to get out there, and we're Steve and Jim Fix the World While Drinking.
You know, our name was too long, so we had to figure out a way to shorten it. And then when we started doing that, we said, you know what, let's shorten the name, but expand our, you know, our reach and what we're bringing to people. And so, you know, really the only thing that's changing is the amount and the volume and the quantity. We just want to bring you more. We want to bring you more of those tough conversations regarding race and politics. We want to bring you more conversations about whiskey, especially good whiskey, like Cleveland Whiskey, which is a local whiskey and a distillery that we were able to tour this weekend. And we have an interview with the CEO, Tom Licks, which will be at the end of this show. Tom was great. The distillery was great. The whiskey that we tasted was great.
The technology we got to see was amazing for me.
Right.
I was geeking out big time.
You were, and you know what? I actually let it ride because it was really fascinating to listen to you and Tom talk about the process from a, you know, scientific standpoint. Science really isn't my game. But you know, you guys, like, I learned
stuff.
A lot. And I know a fair amount about whiskey, and I learned a lot sitting there listening to Tom Licks talk about their process and how it differs from, you know, the traditional distilling process, especially regarding whiskey. And it just got me really excited to know something like that is in our hometown, that's here in Cleveland. You know, it's something that, and if you get an opportunity, like, listen, if you're here locally, you live here, it's worth it to make the trip and go do it. I mean, it's not a big place. They're able to do a lot in a small place. So definitely go check it out. Or if you come to visit and you're looking for something to do, that's something that you can bang out in an hour and it'll be well worth your time.
And, you know, I won't be a spoiler because Tom will explain it better than I will. But I learned a lot, too. And there's just some really great things I learned about whiskey and their approach to producing a product that normally takes 7 years to reach maturity that he can do in 6 months. You know, there's talk of a worldwide whiskey shortage coming because certain markets.
Well, I'll tell you, that whiskey shortage is here.
Right.
You know, and we'll talk about that later. You know, and I'll talk about it more on, you know, some of our shorter sessions on YouTube. But, you know, the whiskey shortage is here, and somebody's got to fill the void, and Cleveland Whiskey is a part of that process.
They're a big part of that. So stick around for that interview at the end. It was a lot of fun. You know, again, I enjoy doing Steve and Jim Fix the World While Drinking with you, but even fighting through saying it now, I'm glad we're making the
jump. Something shorter, something smoother, something easier. Again, we're not really changing what we do. We're just changing how we do it.
Right.
You know, those difficult conversations, you and I have had plenty of intense, dark, deep conversations about the world we live in from a race standpoint, from a politics standpoint. And it's important that I think we continue to do that. It's just that we need to do it better. And so, you know, there's some changes that we're going to make that we've made, that we've committed to making to the show to ensure that it's better. You know, obviously one of those is a show about whiskey sometimes. We talk about whiskey, we drink whiskey, and
sometimes we drink a
little
too much whiskey.
We figured out that we probably need to throttle down the whiskey. I'm sure over the course of time, there may be an episode or two where I'm sure some of you will write in or comment that, hey, it seems like you guys had a little too much that episode. But we'll try to keep those to a minimum.
Yes, agreed.
So that being said, let's jump into a couple topics. Just some stuff that's going on this week that I think we absolutely need to cover. You know me.
And
as a listener, if you've been listening to us, I am a relatively black and white guy when it comes to like wins and losses. Like, I'm not a moral victory person. If you've paid attention to what's going on, there are a number of special elections that have happened as different people have taken spots in Trump's administration. Some seats in Congress or Senate or in Congress have opened up, and so they've had these special elections, right, to fulfill vacated seats. And the Democrats' thought on this is, or was, I guess now, because I believe all the special elections are over, their thought was, this is a way, because, you know, the Democrats took a pretty good beating during the election season. You know, during the elections, you know, just Democrats just got beat up. I mean, it started at the top, but I mean, it was all the way through. Republicans and the GOP control the House, they control the Senate, they control the presidency, they have control over the Supreme Court. This is not a good situation.
Not for Democrats, right?
Democrats are looking at it and saying, okay, well, we have these special elections, so we can begin to claw back, you know, some control. If we can win a majority of these special elections, you know, we can start to make headway for 2018. And their strategy, and I'm using air quotes here for those listening on the podcast, their strategy was to use the misgivings and the mistakes of the Trump administration to, you know, point out, like, listen, this is what we elected. As a country, we made a mistake, so elect Democrats in these special elections, and that'll be the momentum we need in the 2018 to set things back right if you're a progressive on the left or a Democrat or what have you. And that was that. I think that was your strategy.
That was a strategy. I think I know for a fact that one of your huge pet peeves was the first couple special elections got closer than people expected. They were in districts that Trump won by, you know, 20% plus, and the Democrat only lost by single digits. And some Democrats were declaring that as a victory in a referendum, and your point was, no,
that's not a victory. I mean, at the end of the day, end of the day, don't let me say that.
All right. Well, I'm going to stop you.
I don't know how you're going to stop the words coming out of my mouth, but figure something out. You can use my bottle cap.
The bottle cap?
But for Democrats, and this idea that, oh, well, we got closer than we expected, that's a win, that's momentum. No, that's a loss. That person is now in office for, you know, the next 4 years. So, the next 2 years. That's not a win, right? You actually don't get another shot at this.
We came closer than we thought we would.
Right, you don't get another shot at this for another 2 years. You didn't do anything. You didn't accomplish anything. Special elections, one, are no way to gauge where we are as a country, because you get low turnout. The people who, you know, the people who do vote are it's relatively predictable how they're going to vote, because if they're that involved, then there's a pattern, there's a history there. It just, for me, if the Democrats were going to actually turn the tables and they were actually going to get more control, then they had to win these elections. And not a majority of them, they had to win all five. Right?
Is it five or four?
No, there are five.
Okay.
They needed to win all five because the numbers are so skewed in favor.
Oh, for it to matter in those 2 years.
Right. The numbers are so skewed in favor of Republicans in Congress right now that those five would have made an impossible task, right? Somewhat, they would have opened a peephole of light at the end of the tunnel. And right now, it's just black.
Another thing it would have done is it would have sent a chill up the spine of every incumbent Republican. So all the Republicans who are sort of staying in lockstep with the president, even if they're expressing some disappointment, they're not challenging the stance of the White House right now.
No.
And if Republican seats started falling to Democrats in these special elections, you would see the one only consistent thing in a U.S. representative is their desire to protect their own seat.
Right. And so it's to get reelected.
Yeah, right.
And so
that's what I meant by
if Republicans see seats falling to Democrats in these special elections, then their willingness to all of a sudden break away from Trump and start to say, I have to focus on what's most important in my district. And maybe that means working with Democrats. Maybe that means backing out of this healthcare bill. Maybe that means, you know, not supporting some of this, some of the different issues with immigration. You would have seen, I can guarantee you, you would have started to see that.
You would have.
But not had a majority of, I mean, and we're talking about 3 out of 5 seats, but that's enough to shake the foundation. But instead, you had the opposite effect. You didn't win any. You went 0-5.
And the most recent one, they spent a ton of money.
Right, they spent $30 million in Georgia for Ossoff, and Karen Handel beats him by about the margin she should have beat him by. And, you know, Democrats are like, I can't believe we lost. I don't understand. And, again, it was the message that they tried to send. And the whole thing is Trump's failing. He's not doing what you want. And while you can say, well, he hasn't had a specific piece of legislation passed that really impacts anyone, and you've got these special investigations going on, you still don't have any solid evidence or proof, or you don't have anything substantial either way, right? I don't think that the GOP and Trump and his administration, they don't have anything substantial to hang their hat on and say, we're killing it. But at the same time, the Democrats don't have anything to hang their hat on and say, they're shit in the bed.
You're right. It's funny because Republicans are claiming victory on certain things like, you know, the economy, which really isn't impacted that quickly by an administration.
Right.
I
think some of the things that we saw early on were a direct result of Trump being elected. You know, confidence for, you know,
consumer confidence, all right,
things like that could have shifted. But
job growth doesn't happen.
No.
In
Trump's elected. Let's add jobs.
Let's add jobs.
That's
right.
Exactly how it works.
And. I mean, the Trump administration has made self-congratulation and hyperbole an all-time new thing. And I'm not, you know, before anyone says anything about my Trump bashing, if you can't see that, you're just not looking at the same world I am. I mean, he uses things like the best, the biggest, the greatest, you're going to get sick of winning, blah, blah, blah. That's been his thing. So you're never going to hear from the administration anything other than a declaration of victory.
We're doing great, no matter what happens, right?
And one thing that frustrates me is their ability to get away with talking out of both sides of their mouths, and particularly, you know, everything related to his tweets and his, which is crazy that we're talking about the president tweeting, but there were all these tweets about how the Russia thing was a witch hunt, the Russia thing was unsubstantiated, and then something leaks this week where an Obama official basically says that they knew about the Russian attempts to influence the elections and that it was steering it towards Trump, and they chose not to politicize it during the election. And now there's a Trump tweet saying, if Obama knew about the Russia thing, why did he do anything, calling Obama a failure because that scores points. But now he's tweeting that he's admitting there was a Russia thing.
Well, it's unbelievable, right? Trump's big thing was Russia, fake news, no collusion, what are they doing, witch hunt, all that stuff. Kellyanne Conway comes out today and says, it's Obama's fault that there was any hint of Russian collusion, it's Obama's fault that the Russians hacked the election, and it's Obama's fault that he didn't stop it.
Right.
And I've been critical of Obama in the past. Just certain areas, especially when it came to foreign policy, I felt that he could have been much firmer and had some better positions.
I agree.
Now, the Trump administration and the GOP have now decided across the board that no matter what, all sentences must begin with, Obama was terrible. It's Obama's fault. Obama, had Obama done something better, that like they, listen to a conservative talk on an interview, on the radio, and on TV, in person, without them first blaming Obama for something.
Or Hillary.
Yeah, fair, but mostly a lot of it is geared towards Obama, and I think I have my opinions on why. But there's you can't hear somebody from the GOP talk without them first blaming Obama for the fact that their wife got their period on a Thursday. Like, it's unfucking believable.
And it's an applause line, right?
Right. I mean, it is. It's just a talking point that they've all taken. And so for Kellyanne Conway to come out, like, it falls right in line, right? She comes out and she's like, well, so what happened is that they finally had to acknowledge, like, okay, listen, we can't avoid the fact that Russia absolutely tried to hack our election. We know this, right? Like, the intelligence committees have said, listen, they're coming out and saying, we're not going to show you the exact data that we have, but it's there. Right? I mean, they literally tried to get into election headquarters and software and affect the vote. We know that they, on social media, had people whose sole job was to put out propaganda, you know, as close to hate speech as possible, start Facebook groups and rope people in. Like, that's what they did. Their strategy was to destabilize our election.
And a lot of people will say this, and this is absolutely true, that, well, all they did was expose Democratic emails that were real, and that showed an ugly side of the Democratic process, the Democratic Party's process. And that's 100% true.
It did.
But you know what? I guarantee you, if you leaked Trump team emails, you'd have seen ugliness there too. The fact that if you only show the warts of one side, then you only embarrass the one side.
You only embarrass the one side.
And if you feel through 100 people's emails and cherry pick the top 100 emails out of 100 people over 6 months, or you get some doozies out of me, I can tell you.
Well, what I will say though is, I don't even know. Like, everyone's saying that Russia hacked the election to get Trump elected. I'm not 100% sure that's accurate. That's what they're saying, and I don't necessarily disagree with it, but the intelligence committees have a little bit of a beef with Trump. You know, I mean, Trump came in right away and attacked the intelligence committees for, you know, leaking, leakers, why aren't you doing this? And he, you know, he grandstanded a little bit against the intelligence committees and agencies, and those guys don't like that. So I can easily see how they're just saying, all right, well, we're going to push the narrative to say that, you know, the hacking happened, and it happened to, you know, get this guy into office and let him deal with it. But I think realistically, the Russians' whole point, they didn't really care who got in office. I don't think they were worried.
I disagree.
I don't think they cared. I really don't. I think their whole point was to, even if Hillary gets in, and they didn't feel that Hillary was going to work with them or whatever, I think their whole point was to cast doubt.
I don't think that they necessarily believe they could get Trump elected, but I think if they had to choose between the two, that's the one they wanted, for a couple reasons. And I think the biggest one is Trump is very predictable. He's easy to manipulate. If you work his ego, he plays right along. Hillary is probably as predictable too, and maybe.
Hillary, I mean, don't forget the Russian reset.
Hillary will blow with the wind.
Hillary's played pretty nice with the Russians at her time as an elected official. So this idea that it made, you know, just as much sense, if you want to say because he's not stable and you can somewhat control him by stroking his ego, I won't disagree with you.
And then there's also the question of how much Russian-related influence is there over Trump based on financial?
That's probably more of where you want to focus than anything else.
When you've got someone with a giant ego and you've got the ability to blackmail them, you hold a huge card.
And I don't even know if it's necessarily blackmail, but I mean, you know, a lot of if you listen to what Trump says, he says he doesn't have any investments in Russia, right? But the issue is, you're right, he doesn't have investments in Russia, but there's a lot of Russian money invested in his hotels, in his properties, all across the world, right? I mean, and Russians, what they did was when our financial structure went to shit in 2008, and we, you know, homes being foreclosed on, commercial buildings being foreclosed on. The Russians saw an opportunity. A lot of people saw an opportunity. A lot of criminal entities saw an opportunity. They literally parked cash into vacant buildings, massive structures in New York City that were being built, multi-million dollar condos that no longer could be afforded because, the person who was building it or who, was going to buy it, just complete all their money was gone due to, things that happened in 2008. So now these places are sitting empty. And whether it was the Russian government or the Russian mob or Vladimir Putin and some...
How do you tell the difference?
Sort of, you can't, and it's all connected. There were Chinese government entities, there were Chinese, gangsters, there were, American, the drug dealer, everybody. What they were doing is they were buying these places in cash, using shell corporations and parking it and saying, all right, well, I bought this building, I don't have to live in it, I don't have to do anything, but it's holding money. And a lot of those properties were Trump properties, right? I mean, especially down in Florida, there are multiple stories. And of course, it's the Washington Post, which Washington Post, by the way, little side story, I need them to kind of calm down a little bit. I get they've got a thing against Trump, but now they're starting to look a little biased. you want to hold some sort of objectivity. You have to hold it. Someone needs to hold this administration accountable. But I feel like they need to kind of spread that around because it's easy for Trump and his administration to say fake news, look at them, they're lying, they're making it up, whatever, because they're the only ones coming out with it. How they fix that, I don't know. But anyway, back to this whole thing with follow the money, right? Essentially, follow the money to Trump properties from Russians, and that's where you get your, can Trump be manipulated by the Russians? And maybe he's not. Right? Maybe he can say, I'm not beholden to any of that. I can completely separate it. But the look of impropriety, the look of the ability to be blackmailed, the look of being able to be manipulated because, your Mar-a-Lago or whatever has millions of dollars from a Russian investor who happens to be the secretary administrator of defense nonsense in Russia, calls in and says, we need this. And by the way, if you don't give it to us, then we're going to pull the $2 million that we put into your property.
$2 million.
That's only scratching the surface. But I mean, that's where a lot of this, all of this is coming from, right? This whole idea of what is Russian collusion and its impact on our administration.
It is. I have to bring up one stupid story. I know it's going to bug you, but sorry. The video.
I feel like you're not sorry because
you're right.
You're actually telling me.
So there was a video that came out this week of Trump driving his golf cart on the green. This is funny.
Okay.
Because if you're a golfer,
be funny.
If you're a golfer,
be funny.
You know that's something you just do not fucking do. He didn't only do it. He did it in the most unsubtle, ridiculous, dickish fashion and then walked off. And he's getting filmed by these guys who are like, look at this guy. He's driving it right on the green. He then drives by, high fives the people filming him. Yes, I'm doing it to be funny. Yes, I'm doing it to be goofy.
Jim,
yes, sir?
Let me ask you this. Where did this take place?
On his golf course.
Oh, the golf course that he owns.
Yes.
So
if anyone else did that, they'd get thrown out of there.
Right.
And if you're going to say that...
It's his golf course.
Listen,
if you own a golf course, everything being the same, but you have the money to own your own golf course, right? And you being you, and me being me, and I got you drunk, all right?
Would I drive on the
green? What are the chances that I could get you in a golf cart driving around like an asshole?
You would never get me to drive on the green.
Bullshit.
Never. Never.
Bullshit.
Never. Never. Never.
You don't even own a golf course, and I guarantee you I can get you drunk enough to go riding around in a golf cart on the green.
I guarantee you
get us kicked out of a golf course.
You could get us kicked out, but not for that.
Oh.
If I'm driving?
Excellent.
I'm driving? Okay.
Hold my whiskey, bitch.
it would not happen. But anyway, do you want to finish up with...
Yeah, I do want to... I mean, so, listen... For Kellyanne Conway to come out and blame the Obama administration for Russian collusion is par for the course. It's deflection. They're trying to divert attention away from the fact that they denied that there was anything going on with Russia at all, that Russia had any impact on anything. And so now they're doing a rudimentary diversion tactic that, unfortunately, people are going to fall for and believe. And immediately on Monday, tomorrow, you listen to Breitbart, you listen to Sean Hannity, and they're going to fall right in lockstep. Yep, it's Obama's fault that this even happened. They're going to completely ignore the fact that they were ignored, that they were pretending that there was no impact, there was no interference from Russia. They're going to go down the line that there was, ignore the fact that there was any Russian, you know, there was the threat of collusion with the Trump administration, and they're going to go to, well, it's Obama's fault.
And
it's going to work. And their followers,
their audience will eat that up.
They'll eat it up. They'll eat it up. And I mean, you know, there's plenty. If you've listened to our show for an extended period of time, you have been saying that there is more than enough suspicion and reason for the inquiry. Right now, do we agree with the strategy that the Democrats and Congress have taken and the Senate? No, I don't. I feel like there's just, in terms of strategy, it's like no one has it anymore. Right? No one knows how to play chess. I don't even know if these people know how to play checkers. It feels like everyone is playing. Yes. But that being said, there's something there. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Right? And there's a hell of a lot of billowing smoke right now.
There is. So we'll see where this goes.
But it's going to go nowhere. Like, this is going to blow over. In the next couple of days, something else is going to come out. And everyone's going to forget about this shit that Kellyanne Conway is saying. And they know it. That's why they do it. They being Sean Spicer, Kellyanne Conway, the whole Trump administration. They know that they can say and pretty much do whatever they want because they control the White House. They control the Senate.
Yep.
They control Congress. They control the Supreme Court. Fuck. They control 32 states out of the 50. They have control over everything. So who is actually going to stop them?
And yet, themselves, because they still find ways to trip over themselves. Finding ways to, you know, they're still trying to win a campaign. And in fact, they're even regressing beyond
that. They're still having campaign rallies. They just had one in Iowa.
Where they talked about coal, where Trump went to a campaign rally style event in Iowa, and it talked about coal mining.
Right.
There's no coal in Iowa. You don't mine for corn.
No. It's amazing. So just throwing that out there, it popped up today. We figured it was worth talking about. You know, be aware of it. Look at it. Listen with a third ear. Watch with a third eye. You have to be able to read between the lines. And it's not even... what this administration is doing. It's just, I mean...
It's important for the Democratic Party not to take the bait, though. Don't start defending Obama, all right.
You know, it's too late, though. You know, I mean, I have no faith in the Democratic leadership. I have no faith in the Democratic Party to handle anything the right way.
Let me throw one more thing at you.
I mean, they cannot stop kicking themselves in the fucking dick to save their lives, the Democratic Party. It is Tom Perez. I had a little faith in this guy. I was like, oh, well, maybe he will bring to the table what they need to change that. Nope, this guy is actually worse than Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
One of the issues that came up on Sunday morning TV today was, should Nancy Pelosi be removed as Speaker, minority leader?
Yes.
Well, I stopped listening because...
I mean, the answer is yes, but for the reason that they're saying, I mean,
it's yes for a variety of reasons. But it's as soon as I heard, you know, these Democrats are calling for a change, and you know, Nancy Pelosi says I'm not going anywhere. I thought this is a story to tune into in 3 or 4 weeks because nothing's going to happen. And if the Democrats start infighting amongst themselves with all the shit going on,
if they continue and it escalates, which it is and it's going to, they're going to cannibalize themselves. I firmly believe that this party is the Democratic Party is moving further and further left. And in doing so, it's creating factions. They're going to cannibalize themselves. And by the time we get to 2018, if they continue on the path that they're going right now, the loss that we saw in 2016 won't look that bad. 2016 will look okay compared to what will happen in 2018 if the Democrats don't get their shit together.
See, I don't see them going further left as a group. I see them scattering. So some people are running towards, maybe we need to be a bit more right. Maybe we need to be a bit more anti-immigrant. I was watching Tom Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, today on the morning shows. And I'm watching this guy tap dance between how to make coal miners happy and be a Democrat. And it's not pretty.
I this isn't you, but I mean, yes, there's some scattering, but the leadership of the party, Keith Ellison, Tom Perez, they're pushing left.
Oh, definitely. And good.
Okay, but you continue to push left. You continue to get more and more progressive. You continue to alienate the people that did not vote for you. And alienate people who did vote for you but are starting to lose faith in you, and you're going away from them. That's not a good strategy. Okay, if you want to win, right? You want to win. You want to actually win an election, not be close in the election. Then you need to start to do things that will allow you to win. Okay, and doing things like, listen, you want to do those things that make you feel good, like a better person.
No, not you.
I'm just saying, as a party, you know, doing it for the people, or we're doing it for the kids, or we're doing it, blah, blah, blah. Okay, great. Well, you're getting your ass kicked in every single election. Single election, you're losing.
To me, though, it's almost as much as not owning what you are and owning what you mean, what you believe in, and just trying to tap dance and not. I don't think the Democratic Party in 2016 thumped Obama's successes nearly enough. They knew that people had been hearing how terrible things were, and rather than say, really, let's rewind from 8 years and look at where things have gone, instead of doing that, they didn't stand strong in Obamacare. They didn't, well, some of them did, but they weren't unified. A house divided
cannot stand. And I completely agree with you that they didn't do that. I question that. You question that. We've both been questioning that since 2015. We needed to hear more. You have to, like, you can't be the humble, quiet, stoic, black, like, you can't be Tony Dungy, right? Tony Dungy and every coach other than Mike Tomlin that's came from him, right? Every black head coach, right? The complaint about them all, Lovie Smith, right? They all have that, I'm quiet, I'm stoic, I'm not gonna rock the boat, I'm gonna let my work speak for itself. No, you gotta be brash, right? You have to have the record of Bill Belichick, but you have to have the attitude of a Rex Ryan in this political battlefield that we're dealing with.
But definitely not the reverse of that.
You have to have the record of Bill Belichick and you have to have the attitude of Rex Ryan. Do not reverse that at all. Right. What we needed from Obama was him to say, I am the man. Actually, I killed it for the last 8 years. You motherfuckers
in spite of
owe me.
Bucks. Yeah.
Right. We needed Keegan-Michael Key to actually be his voice and say, I am the reason why you guys are okay right now. Right. You motherfuckers owe me. High five all around. I'm the man. That's what we needed. Right. And we needed him to transfer that right to Hillary. But he didn't. Right, he took the, nope, I'm just going to be humble, I'm going to let my actions speak for themselves, and we got our ass kicked.
There was a lot of factors,
but again, a lot of that was the Democrats just not being ready. So right? They weren't ready, they didn't have a strategy in place, and it ended up killing them, and it's having a huge negative impact on the country right now. They need to right this ship. We need to write this conversation. Let's get out of politics.
All right. You almost transitioned to some sports.
I was trying to.
Okay, that's not bad. All right, so this is, like, in my opinion, like the worst time of year for sports because it's the middle of the NBA's middle of Major League Baseball season, which I love baseball, but it's the middle of the season and there's no other major sports going on. So then there's always the off seasons. And this is really the key. The NBA offseason is going to be really crazy this year.
So, well, I don't know. I don't know how. Well, actually, yeah.
It's already been pretty interesting.
I mean,
Blake Griffin and CP3 have already just said, we're out.
Right. They've opted out of their contracts.
Dwight Howard got traded again.
You know, which isn't even a big story, which tells you kind of where the NBA is going. But, you know, you see Jimmy Butler go from Chicago to Minnesota. But all that is really...
Let's talk about where we live.
That's that. All that is nothing, right? At the end of the day, the story, the NBA, and a lot of the sports world revolves around what happens here in Cleveland. Right? And that's not us just saying, oh, we love Cleveland. It's all, you know, no.
Three finals in a row.
No, we've got LeBron James. LeBron James is the center of the sports universe right now. And there's a lot of talk, well, LeBron is going to go to L.A. He's going to go to the Clippers or he's going to go to the Lakers. He may go to New York. But a lot of the conversation is centered around the fact that LeBron isn't going to stay in Cleveland, that he's going to spurn the city again. He delivered the championship, and he wants out. He wants to go be Hollywood, and he's got a house here. Listen, first of all, if you go by where LeBron house has houses, so...
LeBron house.
Right. Like, I mean, like, if you all right, well, wherever he's got a house, there's a chance he could play there. If you look up LeBron James, like, in the properties that he owns... that dude's got a house in Raleigh, North Carolina.
I was saying, apparently he can play in San Juan.
He's got a house in Bali. I mean, who's got a house in Bali? LeBron. I mean, so he can live. This whole thing of he needs to live in L.A. to be L.A. If you're some struggling artist, if you want to be a cartoonist or you want to do voice work or you want to be an actress or an actor and you got no cash and you have no resources, then you need to be in L.A. because you're going to get a phone call and within a day you need to be able to show up at an audition. LeBron James has planes. Not one. He's got multiple planes. He can be anywhere he needs to be in less than 12 hours. Okay, so it doesn't matter if LeBron is in L.A. or Cleveland or Miami or San fucking Juan.
20 years ago, big markets mattered in terms of money.
Absolutely.
Because if you want to get local advertising money and you were in New York versus Cleveland or Buffalo, big difference. I mean, you know, forget salaries. Now we're talking about what can you get outside of the game. LeBron does okay outside of the game. Does just fine in the game. But the lifetime deal with Nike, not bad.
Is that worth $1 billion?
Was it actually $1 billion? It was real close. It was a mere 900 million.
It was like 50 or 100 million short of $1 billion.
Yeah.
Which was funny to me because there were actually people say, oh, well, you know, it's not worth $1 billion. So, like... Okay.
People know what $1 billion
is. Right. I mean, it's just like, you know, when Dr. Dre sold Beats to Apple, and they're just like, well, you know, they're saying he made $1 billion, but he didn't actually make $1 billion. He only made like $700 million. So, I mean, come on. Is it even that big of a deal?
I love when you do your Valley Girl voice.
Right. And I'm sick right now, so my voice is a little deeper than it normally is, which, sorry.
All right.
Normally it's bad.
Whiskey, it is.
But here's the deal. I think that from... Listening to all these different, you know, whether it's ESPN or Fox Sports 1, whoever listens or watches that, all these conversations about where LeBron is going. LeBron isn't going anywhere. He doesn't have to go anywhere. He doesn't want to go anywhere. LeBron likes the fact that he's home. He likes being able to, you know, go home to his home in Bay, or not Bay,
I was out of Akron, I forget.
Yeah, I forget where it is. But he's got a home outside, shortly, like right outside of Akron. You know, he loves being able to come home for different holidays and be home. He likes the fact that his kids are going to school here. His wife likes being here. You know, he's got a very young daughter that I believe will be a year old. And he enjoys that. And
another thing about being the gotta go to LA, gotta go to New York thing is... 20 years ago, to get the celebrity nationally, you needed to be in that market.
Right. You don't need any of that shit anymore.
Not when you're LeBron.
Well, not when you're LeBron. And, I mean, this is the internet age. As much as, you know, Steve Bannon and Donald Trump hate the whole idea of globalization, you can't roll it back. I mean, we're all interconnected. LeBron has advertising that is seen all over the world. LeBron can touch any country that he wants. He has touched almost every country across the nation. So this whole idea that he has to be anywhere, the only place he has to be is where he wants to be, right? And he wants to be home. He can do whatever he wants to do from a Hollywood standpoint, from right here,
yeah,
if he wants to. You know, because he's...
The fact is, he has the ability contractually to leave, right. And right now... The media needs things to talk about.
Right. And he, LeBron, to his credit, is not going to give up his power position. And his power position is that he's only signing these 1 or 2 year deals with the Cavs to keep them on their toes. Right. He, ideally, the Cavs would say, will you just please sign a 4 year deal so we can have one off season where we're not talking about you going somewhere else. And LeBron is saying, which is an intelligent thing to do, is just saying, no, I'm going to just keep the pressure on you. Right? Like, am I going anywhere? No. But you guys need to stay on your toes. You guys need to continue to make sure that this team gets better. You guys need to make sure that you don't do anything stupid and hurt this team and put me in a situation where I can't make the finals. Right? I mean, and as long as this team stays intact as is, then there's no reason why they won't be able to go to the finals for the next couple years.
Right. So assuming that you're correct, which I believe you are, what move should the Cavs make to, whether you say to make LeBron happy or to strengthen their position as a team to potentially beat Golden State?
Well,
because those guys aren't going anywhere either.
Ultimately, it comes down to their ability to beat Golden State. And one, they need to get a general manager under contract.
That would help.
Maybe it's Chauncey Billups. Maybe it's not. You know, maybe it's somebody in-house. But once they get the GM under contract, what really killed the Cavs was, one, first couple games was their defense. Like, their defense was atrocious. You know, they had mental lapses, and then they had guys just getting flat-out beat. And once those guys were beat, they were fouling guys. And you can't foul the best shooting team that we've seen in the league ever in the act of shooting because they still make it.
Right.
You know, I mean, the game two, you know, J.R. Smith and Jefferson, all of them were, like, fouling Kevin Durant, Steph Curry outside the three-point line, and those guys were continuing and still making the shots. So they were hitting a three and getting a foul shot. That happens once every 20 games during the regular season, and it happened 4 times in one game. So defensively, they need to get better. They also need to be able to score with Golden State. They need someone that they can rely on that can sit on the three-point line and just shoot and not have to worry about it going in, which is what you thought you were getting with a Kyle Korver. They
right.
either need Kyle Korver to get comfortable and get back to stroking it, or they need to find somebody.
So the big rumor is going to be Carmelo Anthony. If he gets bought out, does he come to Cleveland? And do you want him?
That's hard. Because that whole thing about defense, he
doesn't
fill
game.
That void. But in terms of being able to fill up the bucket, he can do that. But he's such a liability on defense. Now, maybe coming to a team with LeBron where we've seen Kyrie get better on defense, we've seen Kevin Love get better on defense. They're not all pro defenders, but they've gotten better. So maybe in this environment where... Listen, we're going to the finals, and if you actually want that ring, you're going to have to play defense.
Defense in the NBA is basically about athleticism and effort.
I would actually flip it the other way around.
Okay, but
well,
those are the two main factors. My point is,
we saw Matthew Dellavedova, who's not the most athletic, who was a hell of a defender.
Right.
In the right situations. So, I mean, I really think because they're all really athletic. It's
my
the NBA.
My point is effort. Matters a lot on
right.
that side of the ball.
It's a huge part of the equation. So that's what it comes down to. And so what the Cavs need is someone who could fill it up that's not a fucking complete liability on defense. That's what they need. That's what they have to find. Who that is right now, I don't know. You know, because if you, you know, looking at it, Danny Green from the Spurs, who used to be a Cav, is a possibility. It's not Paul George. I know everyone's saying Paul George, and that's just the popular thing. That's not going to work because you'd have to give up too much to get him, and there's no guarantee that he's going to sign. It's just I don't think that's going to happen. You know, the other thing was Jimmy Butler, but that obviously didn't happen because he ended up in Minnesota. So I think it's not going to be a big name that's going to be the piece here. What we need is, again, that we need that assassin type shooter, that guy out on the arc, out on the perimeter, just stroking threes that can defend.
Agreed. So we've talked a lot of, you know, a bit of sports now. We did politics. We really didn't hit on race. I had something funny happen to me yesterday, and I'm going to see if I can make you laugh with it. I'm flipping through channels, and I accidentally end up on the movie Birth of a Nation. Now, I end up on the movie Birth of a Nation.
Which one? There's two. There's the original Birth of a Nation.
No, the new one. The new one.
Okay.
Birth of a Nation on HBO Latino. So it was the Birth of a Nation story being spoken in Spanish. And I thought, this is a Trump follower's worst nightmare. Black people fighting back while speaking Spanish.
Story of Nat Turner.
Nat Turner, as told by... I will put that together as a better joke next time. I thought it was funny. I thought it was funny.
Interesting.
Apparently you don't agree. But I appreciate you humoring me, even if you don't believe there was any humor coming back. All right, man. Anything else you want to talk about?
I do want to talk about how awful that transition was, but we can do that later.
All right.
But listen, thanks for listening. Please continue to listen. We're going to go ahead and jump to our interview with Tom Lix on Cleveland Whiskey Now. Again, interesting stuff, talking about whiskey, talking about innovation, talking about Cleveland. Please tune in, continue to listen, and
look, like for, said, look for Cleveland Whiskey in stores. It's available all around the area and in, like he said, like 16 states and 4 countries.
I believe so. Right. So pay attention to that. Please subscribe to the podcast, iTunes, Google Play, find YouTube. Us on social media, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Even we got a Pinterest site so you can pin some of our whiskey images and other things. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks a lot. How you doing? This is Jim and Steve from Whiskey Congress. We are here with Tom Lix of Cleveland Whiskey. We just got a tour of the distillery, which was awesome, sir. Thank you very much.
Good. Glad you liked it.
Got to sample some really great bourbon. If you know our show and know us, we reside in Cleveland, and Mr. Lix is a transplant to Cleveland, but he's made it his home just like I guess I'm a transplant too, and so are you, I guess. Not from as far. But anyway, we just enjoyed some great bourbon style whiskeys and looked at the process. His process is amazing. It makes great whiskey in roughly 6 months, whereas most whiskeys get aged 7 years. And the stuff is every bit as good.
Tim, how about this? Why don't we let Tom give a little rundown of how the whiskey works since, you know.
I'm geeking out a bit too much. All right, Tom, tell us what your process.
So we do. We're not a craft distillery. We're not a micro distillery. We're really an innovation and technology company, and we use some technology to do things a little bit differently. Normally, when you make a spirit, it comes off a still, it goes into a barrel, and in that barrel is where you're getting 80% of the flavor and 100% of the color. But it's a slow process. You know, you're sitting there every day waiting patiently. The temperatures are changing. The pressure changes inside the barrel. The liquid is going in and out of the pore structure of the wood, and that's where you're getting your flavor from. But again, it takes a long time, and I'm not that patient a person. And I think we can do some other interesting things as well. So we take very young spirits. They're all very young bourbons. They meet the legal definition of what a bourbon is. But they're young. You wouldn't want to drink them yet. They don't have the flavor profile that you'd want. We put them in pressure-capable stainless steel containers, and in that container we put the young spirit as well as a measured amount of wood. Control for surface area, size, shape, weight, and moisture content. And then if you can imagine a sponge in a bucket of water, you squeeze that sponge, it's dry in your hand. But when you let it go, the water rushes into the pore structure of that sponge. That's what we do in those tanks. We apply relatively high pressure, drop it into a vacuum. High pressure into a vacuum, highly oxygenated environment, a couple of trade secrets involved in there in terms of our process, but we pull a tremendous amount of flavor out of that wood in a relatively short period of time. That's the first step of what we do. You want me to talk a little bit about...
I can keep going, or you can tell me... No, no, just a little bit more, just to... you know, because people, if they're familiar with whiskey, what they know is it goes into the barrel, it sits in the barrel,
yeah.
You taste it over the course of 10 years, mm-hmm. and then it goes into a bottle.
Right.
Your process is not that at all, really. Yeah. So maybe going into the next step of what you guys do.
Well, and barrels, they're really an important part. They've been an important part of whiskey for many, many generations, and before that, other spirits. You know, for thousands of years, we've been using these barrels. Really started more in Europe, using the European oaks. You made a barrel container. The barrel was designed as a storage container. It did everything from handling grain, spirits, wines. You'd use barrels to preserve fish. You put a layer of salt, a layer of fish, a layer of salt, a layer of fish, pack it up. You could preserve fish for a pretty long time. They were designed to be rolled down dirt roads and up on the planks on the ships. They weren't designed to give flavor to something. That was an accidental discovery that leaving your spirits in a barrel for a long period of time, it would taste better. And that's what we do. And there's nothing wrong with that. It makes perfectly good spirit. But we're sort of stuck using a certain type of oak, our American white oak, the European oaks. They expand just the right amount. They make a barrel that holds liquid. There might be some other great flavors from other woods, woods like black cherry or apple or peach or pecan. Nobody's really been able to discover that because you can't make a barrel out of those woods. They would leak like a sieve.
That's the thing that I learned today that I was so most fascinated by. Was, yeah. I always knew they were done in oak, and I thought, must be because oak provides a flavor. Now they char the oak and do other things. But you let us taste a hickory whiskey that was just outstanding.
Yeah, so we take very young spirits, and instead of then putting oak into our reactors, we put in hickory, for instance. And that wood gives it an entirely different flavor than a black cherry wood or a honey locust or a sugar maple or an oak would do. So we get these finishes. Everything we're making right now is a bourbon. It's technically a bourbon. We start with a young bourbon, but then instead of using oak to finish it off by leaving it in a barrel for years or even adding wood to our oak to our process, we use these other woods. Some of them are charred, some of them are toasted, some are just air dried. And we experiment all the time. I mean, I think this week we did persimmon, for instance. You know, and it's really an interesting flavor.
Where do you find persimmon wood?
We have a new a collaborative agreement with the Holden Arboretum. And so we're getting a range of different woods that we're testing, and that was one of the first ones that we tested.
Look for that.
It's a lot of fun, it's interesting, and we're doing things that, quite frankly, nobody else in the spirits world can do.
Right. We talked a little bit before that, you know, the world is facing a whiskey shortage, mm-hmm. and if the whiskey snobs want to say, I'm not going to drink a young whiskey, that's fine. You don't like it. We'll be fine.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, we've talked about this. We've consumed your whiskey on our show multiple times, maybe a couple times a little too much. And I mean, it's great. We both like it. I can admit that I can be whiskey snobbish at times, and initially, you know, under having a small understanding of the process is kind of like, it's kind of young, and then but over the last, I would say, 2 years. Mm-hmm. Every time we've had a bottle on the show, I've been gifted bottles of Cleveland whiskey, and every time I drink it, I really feel it gets better and better each time.
You know, thanks for bringing that up, because I think that's one of the key advantages to using the technology. We are constantly experimenting. We are trying new things, not just new woods, but changing the parameters of how we do this. And unlike a traditional distillery, where if they want to make something better, and you know they all do. You know, where you say, okay, I'm going to make something, I'm going to put it in a barrel, I'll try it at 2 years, not bad. Let's wait another 2 years, 4 years, not bad. 6 years, hey, this is looking promising. Maybe at 8 years, they say, hey, this is pretty good. Now it's like, okay, now let's make some more. So it's 16 years to get there. With us, almost every day, we are trying new things. And if it makes any one of our whiskeys taste better, we incorporate that into our process. So the very next batch of bottles that's coming out has that improvement built into it. I'm not trying to essentially blend it back to what it tasted like 50 years ago or 100 years ago, because I think we'll just keep trying to make it better. Sometimes I have people complain and they say, gee, you know, I tried one of your whiskeys again. I hadn't tried it for a couple of years. It's really different. I was unhappy. And but then when I talked to him and asked him, I said, well, did it taste better or worse? And they said, well, I must admit it actually tasted a little bit better. Well, that's a good thing. Right. Let's pursue right. that. Let's make them taste better.
So much of it, like, we get brainwashed into thinking, you know, certain things, you get brainwashed into thinking that certain things, because that's the way they were, or that's how they are, that's how they should be. Right. So, you know, we kind of think, oh, well, this whiskey that is, you know, 21 years old is really good, because I've been told it's really good.
Yes.
And yet what you do is say, listen, maybe your 21-year-old whiskey is pretty good, but what I know is I tasted my whiskey after 6 months, tried it, realized I can do X, Y, and Z, made it better. So now, you know, 3 months after that, you now have a better whiskey or however the process. I can appreciate that in just because I've seen it with your products, especially with the underground whiskey that we were talking about before. I've probably had three different underground whiskeys, and they all kind of stand out on their own. Yeah. And none of them was just like, oh, that one's bad, or you were going backwards. It was definitely all going forward. Yeah. So, you know, we can definitely appreciate it from that end.
And I've got nothing wrong with the traditional process. I'm not trying to reject the tradition. I'm saying, look, we've got this. We've got a great base of information and knowledge, and we know how to make it this good. Now let's see if we can make a few things that are different, that might be better, but perhaps off in different directions. I'm not saying that when we take a bourbon and we finish with black cherry wood, it isn't necessarily better than an older bourbon. It's just different.
Right.
And those things can run, it's a different experience.
They can run on parallel tracks.
Absolutely.
You know, you can have your classic and traditional way of doing things, but there's nothing wrong with innovation, which is what you bring here to the city of Cleveland, which I want to talk about briefly. The name of your company is Cleveland Whiskey. We're in the city of Cleveland. You know, you're right in downtown, heart of Cleveland, next to Cleveland State. Could you talk about a little bit just about your company's kind of place in the city we call home now?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because once we named the company Cleveland Whiskey, that was a commitment that said we will be here in Cleveland. You know, you can probably tell from my very thick Boston accent that I'm from Boston. You know, I moved here about 11 years ago. My mom was born and raised here in Cleveland. Her parents were immigrants, came over from Europe. She was born and raised here. She met my father going to Fenn College, now Cleveland State. He was from New Jersey, so they got married right after college, moved to the East Coast. I've lived on the East Coast, West Coast, in Colorado. All over the place, but had never lived here in Cleveland. I visited my grandparents a few times, but, you know, as a young kid, that was it. My mom moved back, though, 11 or 12 years ago, and she got sick. And my wife and I I had just sold a company that I had in Boston. We were about to move to the West Coast, and we said, look, let's come out here. We'll take care of mom. You know, we'll keep her out of a nursing home, and hopefully as she gets better, she'll move with us. And, you know, unfortunately, she didn't get better, but I had a couple of really great years with her. It was the best thing that we could have done. But in the meantime, I fell in love with Cleveland. It is a phenomenal city, sometimes underappreciated, but I love this city. It's a little bit like Boston was, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago. I mean, both cities, Cleveland and Boston, were, you know, world-class industrial cities that fell on hard times. Things change, technologies change, you know, demand for products change. They both fell on hard times. And Boston sort of, you know, it worked itself back up a little bit sooner than Cleveland, but Cleveland is doing that now. It's impressive. It's something to be proud of. I mean, both cities had empty industrial buildings, but buildings that were made to last for hundreds of years. I live in a little brick home in Parma. It's got a brass plaque on it that says who the builders were, who the masons were. I mean, I'm just so blown away by that. It's a little working class home that people took enough pride in to say, hey, we built this home. We've got a great educated workforce, and by that I mean both blue collar and white collar, and you need them both to really make a vibrant city and a working city. We've got fresh water. That's going to be increasingly important. Both Boston and Cleveland had issues with water, but we took care of them. I mean, we should stop talking about the thing that people talk about. There's a company out there that has a beer around here that talks about a burning... Yeah, never mind.
Okay.
I think nobody else talks about that except the people here in Cleveland. We're over that. We're done with that. We've got good quality fresh water. there's just some really great things and some good analogies about what's going on in Cleveland versus what happened in Boston. And we're on the same trajectory in terms of people moving back into the city and doing things downtown. And you know, I remember when I first got here 10 or 11 years ago, I would drive downtown and there was nobody here. Right. I was struck by that coming from Boston.
Right.
Now I move down, now I come down over the weekend and there are things that are happening here. It's not still not Boston, right. But it's making progress. And when I put the name Cleveland Whiskey on the company, that was it. You can't take Cleveland Whiskey and move it back to Boston. We are here to stay.
That's awesome. And the companies you partnered with and stuff, there's so much growing from a technology standpoint in this area.
Yeah.
And just seeing you as one of the, you know, cornerstones, just
I just love this city. I think it's a great city.
I mean, it's
great food scene. Right. Yeah. I mean, Cleveland Clinic is one of the biggest employers here in the city of Cleveland in Cuyahoga County. And Cleveland Clinic is known for its innovation. And I think that this fits so much in line kind of with that. There's other technology companies and even where we're at right now with the magnet program. Yeah. There's a lot going on here that I think that a lot of people out there, because we have a diverse listener and viewership, people that have never been to Cleveland, mm-hmm. who haven't seen it, or maybe they've only been to the airport.
Yeah.
And I think that...
Or people who have lived in Cleveland their entire life but haven't come downtown lately.
Right. They move out to the suburbs, and then that kind of becomes their circle.
Yeah.
But I think that just what you're doing, not only in terms of, you know, providing a great local whiskey, but just the innovation and ingenuity that I can't believe that you're going to be the only person doing this for that much longer, right? I mean, with the demand.
That's why he's got
some right. I mean, we.
That's why I wasn't answering your questions.
Right. I think it's remarkable. You know, I can really appreciate you guys being here. It's great to go to a liquor store and just say, hey, Cleveland whiskey. And it's not just a gimmick.
Yeah.
It's not someone else's whiskey with a sticker slapped over the bottle. To be able to come here and see what you guys do.
Well, and the good news is we're not just making whiskey here for Cleveland. Right. We're making Cleveland whiskey for the world. So, I mean, we're still relatively young. We shipped our first bottle in March of 2013, but we now have distribution in 16 states from New York and New Hampshire, Massachusetts, down to Florida, over into Tennessee, Maryland, Virginia, Illinois, Michigan. I know I'm missing a number of them. But we're also selling the Cleveland whiskey, that Cleveland bottle, the bottle with the big Cleveland on it, that's sold in Germany, France, Belgium, Switzerland, Japan. And we even started selling a little bit last year in mainland China.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and it's Cleveland.
And you know, I'm big into innovation and technology, but when innovation and technology can bring me whiskey, it's even that much better.
I agree.
You build a better electric fence for the dog, great. Yeah, this gets whiskey right in front of me, so that's the best part about it.
No, I totally agree.
Well, Tom, listen, we thank you. We don't want to take up too much of your time. We need you to go down and, you know.
You want me to make more whiskey.
So, you know, thank you for the tour. Thanks for sitting down with us. And, you know, just keep doing what you're doing.
Gentlemen, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
No, appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thank you. Really, thank you so much.
Yeah.
We'll get this up on YouTube this weekend is the plan. And we'll send you.